We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. The Obama administration has announced that the American combat mission in Afghanistan will end in 2014, yet many questions remain about the ability of the Afghan army and the police to defend their country after that point. Questions also remain about the legitimacy and stability of the government of Hamid Karzai, about its ties to Iran, and about any future role in government in Afghanistan for the Taliban. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will be talking with Nushin Arbazadeh. She is an Afghan author, a journalist, analyst, and translator. And we'll try to talk a little bit about current events in Afghanistan and about the continuing relationship between Afghanistan and the United States. And, of course, questions are welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. She grew up in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation and then left when she was young, left the country with her family. They settled in Germany, where she was educated there and also in the UK. She currently is a visiting scholar at UCLA's Center for India and South Asia. Before she went to UCLA, she worked for the British Council, running literary and journalistic projects on intercultural communication with a focus on dialogue with the Muslim world. In 2005, she joined the BBC, where she specialized on media, politics, and society in contemporary Afghanistan. She's authored a couple of books. Her first was titled From Outside In, Refugees and British Society. That was published in 2007. She's also edited an anthology of writings by young journalists of different religious backgrounds who live in Muslim-majority countries. That book entitled No Ordinary Life, Being Young in the Worlds of Islam, that was also published in 2007. And she writes regularly for The Guardian Online on contemporary Afghanistan. As we talk, questions are welcome, so whatever's on the minds of listeners, you certainly can call. Please do be on the topic and try to keep it brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, which is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And you also can send us your comments by email as well, if that would work for you. And the address there is will-talk@illinois.edu. So certainly at any point here, people who are listening are welcome to be involved in the conversation. And Ms. Arbazadeh, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Just to get at the thing that now is perhaps most recently in the news, something the United States hadn't done before, is they have set this end date for combat missions in Afghanistan, 2014. And before that, the idea is that the United States will begin turning security responsibility over to Afghan security forces, and that's expected to be completed by the end of 2012. Something that President Karzai clearly wants the U.S. to get started with. I guess I wonder what you think about, first of all, just the United States now having come out and said in this way, yes, 2014, that's the end date. Does that really mean anything to people in Afghanistan, do you think?
So the interesting thing is that what we are told here in the United States differs from what U.S. officials are telling people on the ground in Afghanistan. On the ground in Afghanistan, people are being reassured that actually the United States is going to stay. And that's why there is sort of people are incredulous on the ground. They don't believe that the army is actually leaving. I spoke to some of my sources in Afghanistan, asked them what they think, because this issue has been around for a while, and their answer was they're not leaving because, you know, they say they've been to embassy parties, for example, or other events, and were reassured that the United States is going to stay. In fact, you know, officials on the ground have been sort of, you know, reassuring people that they had funding for long-term funding. And so the message, there is a gap between the message that is told to the people on the ground in Afghanistan and to us here in the United States.
Mm. Well, do people in Afghanistan, do they somehow think that the United States commitment is an open-ended commitment?
They're actually not sure what's happening, why, you know, the mission was there. There is a lack of communication or, you know, miscommunication, and it's been there from the very beginning. So the Afghans' interpretation of this story since 2001 is quite different from their reading of the story is quite different from you know, what we think about the mission here in the United States. So they have, unfortunately, conspiracy theories are very widespread. So Afghans have their own versions of why NATO is there and fighting among them. You know, sort of one of the ideas that comes up again and again is, for example, that their natural resources and the troops are there because they want to ensure, you know, that they get hold of the resources. There are various conspiracy theories that have been left untackled, unfortunately.
Well, on the whole, is it actually possible to say whether the people of Afghanistan either support or do not support the presence of the United States?
They do support. I can't give you proper figures, obviously, because there are no, you know, exact surveys done about this. But I think repeatedly speaking to Afghans who live there, they really fear the withdrawal of the troops. And the reason for that is that the troops stationed there actually sort of people feel that they prevent a civil war in Afghanistan, even though actually, you know, their presence is also a trigger of violence. So that's the paradox here, that they still prevent a civil war, because at least now the war is restricted to two sides. If the troops were to leave, then we will definitely plunge into a very bloody civil war, which would be worse than the wars we had in the 1990s.
See, it seems very clear that for President Hamid Karzai, this is a very difficult. He's walking a very difficult line here between his need for the United States and the difficulties that the United States and its military presence there causes him.
You're absolutely right, and I think the interesting point here is that the problems and the challenges were there from the inception, from the very beginning of the mission. The only difference is that President Karzai was very close to the Bush administration. So when such problems came up, for example, you know, Afghans complaining about the night raids or civilian casualties, it didn't become a diplomatic issue as such, because the two administrations were very close. They had a personal, you know, Karzai had a personal relationship with Bush, and this sort of also reassured Afghans, because he could always tell them that they're friends, you know, he's close, he knows what he's doing because he's in touch with the President of the United States. Now, with Obama administration, all this has changed, and these problems that have been there since the beginning, basically, they become public diplomatic issues. So that has to do with the relationship, Karzai's relationship with Obama administration, and not so much with, you know, the inherent problems that you get when you have a military intervention.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it seems to be the case that from early on in the Obama administration, maybe even beforehand, there were people who were saying, they were maybe not saying this for attribution, but it seemed pretty clear that the administration was not happy with Mr. Karzai and his government. They've not been happy about the circumstances under which he was elected or at least recently re-elected, and there seemed to be some real questions about whether they had what sort of commitment they actually had to the Karzai government.
That's absolutely true, and but the manner. My interpretation is that because Karzai was very close to President Bush, the Obama administration had to make sure it distances itself from the administration in Kabul. So part of that was, you know, a much more, you know, the opposite of the personal and perhaps a bit laissez-faire relationship that was there between Bush and Karzai. So they did the opposite and actually were, you know, very strict and questioning and perhaps demanding accountability, which didn't take place before. So, but the manner that it was handled was very public, which in terms of diplomacy perhaps was not the wisest thing to do, because Karzai was made to feel embarrassed publicly, and in Afghan culture, that's something, you know, losing face is something that you shouldn't do with people who you work with, basically. So that put him in a very awkward position because he lost face because his allies were openly, publicly criticizing him. Now, from a Western point of view, we would see that as a normal part of democracy, that you have, you know, accountability, that you have open criticism. But from the Afghan side, you know, it's just sort of their interpretation is that Karzai has been made to look like a fool publicly, and obviously the Taliban, for them, it's a sign that America is not going to stay with the president, with Kabul. So that something went slightly wrong there, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Well, there, I think that's one of those things that people would point to as they say it might have not been such a good idea for the United States to say combat mission ends in 2014, because then that will be a signal to the Taliban that all they have to do is sit tight for a couple of more years, and then the United States will leave. And if you couple that with maybe sometimes it looks like lukewarm support for the Karzai government, then you really have to wonder, has the United States really taken the right kind of approach here, at least since President Obama has been president?
There are two sides to this story. So I totally understand why the United States can no longer afford to conduct expensive wars. And also the criticism of the Karzai administration is absolutely valid. You know, the Afghans themselves have been actually complaining about corruption for much longer time than you know, the issue has been picked up in the West. That's absolutely... So this side of the story is absolutely correct, but in terms of public diplomacy, absolutely, because the Taliban's message has been consistent throughout the time. They never changed their opinion. They never really signaled that they might, you know, enter into negotiation. And for them, the way they interpret, you know, these announcements is that, yeah, you know, they have to, all they need to do is to wait for the United States to leave, and then they will take over the country. For them, it's a message of reassurance.
Just perhaps I should introduce again our guest for anyone who has just tuned in the last few minutes, Nushin Arbazadeh. She is an Afghan author and journalist. She grew up in Afghanistan. She now is at UCLA, where she is a visiting scholar at the Center for India and South Asia. She writes regularly for The Guardian online on contemporary Afghanistan, and we're talking about Afghan politics today, and questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just recently, a British military officer, General Sir David Richards, who is a former NATO commander, said, and it's something that got him quite a lot of criticism in Britain. He said recently that he did not think that the Taliban or Al-Qaeda could be defeated militarily. And I don't think anybody here in the United States military has said anything like that, but it certainly seems to be the case that we are moving in this direction that where we think that there's got to be some accommodation between some Taliban and the Karzai government. And it's just a question of how is that going to happen? When's that going to happen? What has to happen? And it certainly seems also that NATO is trying to actually facilitate talks between some representatives of the Taliban and people in the Karzai government. I'm interested in what you can say about what seems to be the posture now of the United States toward the Taliban?
So, you know, the option to talk to the Taliban has been there also, you know, for a long time, since the very beginning. You know, Karzai has repeatedly asked them to join the government side, and his condition has been, you know, that for the Taliban to respect and accept and recognize the Afghan constitution. So that's nothing new there, but certainly the international support for this project has increased, and it has become, you know, for 5 years ago it would have been, you know, quite astounding to hear, you know, any sort of support for negotiations with the Taliban. At the moment, yeah, it seems normal. We get reports every day. Now, again, you know, I think that at the moment, the Taliban have absolutely no incentive to join the government side, because as long as they stay in opposition, they don't have to prove their governance skills. They don't have to prove to show that they actually are capable of running the country. They have the moral high ground in the view of some Afghans for fighting, you know, an invasion, what they see as an invasion. And besides, economically, you know, if they joined the Afghan government, they would just have to share, you know, have a share in corruption, whereas at the moment they control the drugs business. So there is no incentive for them to join the government side. Besides, you know, they have never really, the Taliban leadership has never really signaled its readiness to join the government side. So all this talk about negotiations, in a way, is beside the point, because negotiation with those Taliban who really matter is not going to take place. So it's a one-way communication, basically. The ones who want to join the government are not, you know, they are not high-ranking Taliban. Mm-hmm.
Well, it certainly, I think just recently, Mullah Omar has said very strongly said that there is no way that the Taliban is going to sit down and talk with the Karzai government. And it seems that when Taliban leaders, people talk about their unwillingness to talk with the government, it seems that for them a major issue is the presence of foreign troops. So you wonder, well, just what conditions would have to apply for significant numbers of Taliban at high levels to actually be willing to talk with the government, and would a substantial troop withdrawal of the United States and outside forces be a necessary precondition?
Well, this is how they present their conditions, certainly, that their main problem is the presence of the foreign troops there, and they say that as long as there is no sovereignty, that's what they say, there's no sovereignty in Afghanistan, you know, the government is not in control, they just can't, they don't feel secure enough to enter negotiations. They feel threatened, basically. So that's their condition, that all the foreign troops have to leave. Now, let's go back, you know, to the 1990s. There was no foreign invasion in Afghanistan, and still we had a civil war going on, and the Taliban fought the Mujahideen, who were their former allies, obviously, you know, during the war. So because of that history of, and, you know, their history of, you know, desire to take power and run Afghanistan, so, you know, I at least don't believe that the war is going to stop there, you know, that once the foreign troops leave, the Taliban are going to enter into negotiation and start a new government with Karzai. The reason for that, there is another reason for that, and that's because the Taliban's key enemies are actually mostly people who are now part of this government. If we look back to the 1990s, the Taliban actually fought the Mujahideen, and they took control of Afghanistan, and most of the Mujahideen leaders, they had to leave Afghanistan, they were in exile. They returned to power with the 2001 NATO mission. So from the Taliban's perspective, this was a matter of dishonoring them, because NATO came back to Afghanistan with their former enemies and installed them in the government. So there is a matter of honor for them, you know. They are not going to settle with the people they fought, and then a people who came back to power with the help of a foreign military mission.
Well, does that really mean that this kind of talk about the Taliban or some Taliban entering into negotiations with the Karzai government and possibly being involved in government, is that actually not a realistic possibility then?
Well, I think most Afghans would agree with me that it's not really. It's not. Besides, because while we are talking about settlement and peace, actually other ethnic groups in Afghanistan are starting to rearm and prepare themselves for a future civil war, because, you know, what sounds reassuring to us in the West when we hear, you know, there's going to be negotiations, actually for Afghans is the message, it's the opposite message.
Well, that's really distressing. That makes it sound as if really if the military commanders are saying that Taliban can't really be defeated, and if it doesn't really seem realistic that they're actually going to talk with the government, then it seems that for the foreseeable future, all the Afghan people really have to look forward to is continued conflict.
Yes, they are, and they are preparing themselves. People are trying to leave, or at least to sort of map out the ideas, try to think. I mean, these are people who are actually, again, you know, you have to bear in mind that on the ground in Afghanistan, life goes on as normal, and you know, sort of, you know, people are given a different story, basically. You know, as I said before, speaking to my sources in Afghanistan, the repeated message was that people just don't, you know, they're in denial. They don't want to believe, or they don't believe that the United States is actually leaving, because the message they are given there is completely different. So there is a gap in communication. You know, there's one message for us in the United States and in the West to reassure the public here that there's going to be an end to the war, and there is another message to Afghans on the ground. And that's also absolutely understandable, because we don't want, you know, you don't want the public to panic. They have to be reassured.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that here where we are in Champaign County. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I'm a little puzzled by your last statement that they're planning on Afghans or different ethnic groups are planning on a civil war, and that's predicated on the U.S. leaving. That's the message that we're supposed to be getting here. It's not the message that you just said that they were getting there. I'm very influenced by a piece that was released just on the Council for Foreign Relations just before the Obama discussions to find a strategy at the beginning of the administration. It was called From Great Game to Grand Bargain. It was written by Ahmed Rashid and Barnett Rubin, I guess, calling for a dramatic change. It didn't have any real influence. It seems, getting all the parties in the region, that includes states like Iran, to sit down and have a grand bargain on. I know this might, Afghanistan's rebel against that, I would guess, because their fate has been decided by outsiders for so long, but it's also an acceptance of the fact that there are many players that have been doing this for quite a while. Like I say, it had no real effect. There is a great game. There is a strategic interest. I share the assessment of maybe the average Afghani that the U.S. is there for both strategic and reasons, both of those directly related to power in the area and also to the resources in the area, the lithium, for instance. But I think that we have to get past some of those commonplaces, it seems, before we can assess this. I don't know how you react to this. I have some further points, too. The Northern League is the Northern Alliance is, and the current situation for women in Afghanistan is horrific. I've heard a lot of women speaking, including the woman that was ejected from Parliament some time ago, that this is the wrong thing to base it on, a reason to stay for women's issues, because that presumes that there's something going on that's so much better than it was even during the Taliban region era. It's curious that Najibullah is popular in some of the elites around. In Afghanistan, it's shocking that the last leader of the communist era has gotten to be looked back wistfully on because of anyway, that's an aside, I guess. Again, I'd like to hear some comments.
All right. Well, make some comment on those points?
Yes. So it is absolutely true that regional powers, you know, they're going to play a significant role in shaping the future of Afghanistan. And yes, ideally, what we need is agreement between Russia, China, but particularly Iran and Pakistan and India, not to interfere in Afghanistan. For Afghanistan to return to its original position, which was a buffer state, keeping rival powers in the region at a distance from each other. So this was how Afghanistan was actually created. And some experts argue that we need to go back to that. Afghanistan needs to become a neutral country again, a buffer zone again, because there are rivalries in the region. They have, you know, we have new powers, but but the fact that there are rival powers who are also in conflict with each other is you know, that sort of aspect structurally that still is there in place. But I don't think now we can actually persuade countries like, say, Iran to go for this kind of policy, because they are, in fact, you know, they're expanding. Their idea is to spread political Shiism in the Muslim world. Their view is towards the Muslim world, and they want to influence it as much as they can. So they are expanding their influence rather than retreating. And they have been doing that in Afghanistan too. And our other neighbor, Pakistan, is still very much concerned with the issue of the fear of losing Afghanistan to the sphere of influence of India. And there, the idea, you know, the problem is with Kashmir. And I think, you know, that the governments in the region, apart from India and China, perhaps, they are still, you know, they're not in the, so they don't have the maturity, let's say, to actually, you know, be able to sit down at the negotiation table and you know, agree on Afghanistan where they wouldn't interfere. And that's really unfortunate for us.
And perhaps, I don't know if you, I imagine one could talk for some time about what life is like for women in Afghanistan, but is there anything that you might want to say about that?
Yes, people often bring that up, you know, how important is the issue of women. But obviously in 2001, you know, to get support for the mission in Afghanistan, it really made sense to focus on women in Afghanistan. Not only because their situation was dire and that's, you know, that was a reality, but also, you know, this, we live in the century where the moral development of a society is measured against how it is treating its women. So that's you know, in the past there were other issues, racism, for example, the way society treated minorities, and in this century it's about women. So it made sense, and it got, you know, Afghanistan plenty of support. I do think there have been improvements in Afghanistan in terms of women's situation, at least if not, you know, improvements that you can actually measure right now. But I see a change of attitude among Afghan women. They have discovered a new world outside of Afghanistan through various scholarships and training programs, coming out of Afghanistan, meeting, you know, living in different societies. And it has had a real impact on them. And going back to the previous conditions is going to be very, very hard.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a couple of other callers I wanted to get to. I want to thank the caller, and also perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Nushin Arbizadeh. She's an Afghan author, journalist, analyst, translator. She grew up in Afghanistan. That was during the time of the Soviet occupation. Then her family left and settled in Germany, where she was educated there and in the UK. She currently is a visiting scholar at UCLA's Center for India and South Asia. She writes regularly for The Guardian Online on contemporary Afghanistan. She has worked for the BBC, where she specialized on media, politics, and society in contemporary Afghanistan, and she has authored a couple of books. Her first was From Outside In, Refugees and British Society. That was published in 2007. She's also edited an anthology of writings by young journalists from different religious backgrounds who live in Muslim-majority countries. That book was published also in 2007. It's titled No Ordinary Life, Being Young in the Worlds of Islam. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have several callers here, and we'll talk next with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to thank you for having your guest on. I think it is just terribly important for us to hear from people who really know the civilization in Afghanistan and the situation. My question is, I've just picked up the book by Dexter Filkins, The Forever War. And it was written in 2008. He's the New York Times correspondent. And it seems to me that what we are describing today and in the media is a forever war. And I just heard your guest talk about how people are preparing for the next phase, whatever that is. So I would just like her to comment on that. Obviously, we can't afford a forever war, and we can't solve all the problems in the world. So I'd just appreciate her feedback on that.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, obviously, as long as we're aware that NATO cannot, you know, stay there forever, but what they expected was for them to stay at least as long as there is some sort of stability in Afghanistan and a proper state is in place. And that has not happened yet. And there are various reasons for that. One of them is that the disarmament program that was introduced early on was not fully successful. Not everybody was disarmed. And the reason for that is, again, you know, for Afghanistan to succeed, I think we needed a lot more financial aid, a lot more commitment. We needed a much better planned project. But as we all know, the mission itself was a direct result of something that no one had expected, and that was the September 11th terrorist incidents, which triggered what happened in Afghanistan. So this was not a project that had been planned carefully before, you know, it happened. So I think that also had an impact on the way things developed from then on, because, you know, decisions had to be made on an ad hoc basis fairly quickly without thinking much. And then we had the Iraq war, which also distracted, you know, which meant that financial resources and human resources were then moved to Iraq, and Afghanistan was then neglected for a while. So there are various reasons for things to go wrong, basically, in Afghanistan. Forever war, I think, yes, there is a war economy, and that's also a reason why the conflict has carried on. But I do think Afghans are capable of peace. What they need is really, what we need is commitment and a sense of reassurance that when people disarm, everybody really disarms, and not only one part of the population, which is what happened when President Karzai came to power. The minority groups, they handed in their weapons, but not everybody did. So the conflict carried on. I don't think Afghanistan is, you know, an inherent, it is a complex country, that's true, but I don't think that we are sort of inherently prone to conflict. You know, in the 60s and 70s, when other regions had serious problems, Afghanistan was a very peaceful country, actually the only peaceful country.
We talked a little bit at the beginning about the most recent news, the United States making this announcement that the combat mission there will end in 2014. And the idea is that the Afghan army and police should be ready to take over security responsibilities by the end of 2012. And now the United States and others are engaged in trying to build up the Afghan army and police. But we also read these stories about just how difficult that is. Once people are recruited, it's hard to keep them. Some have gone over to insurgent groups. In fact, the reporter that the caller just mentioned, Dexter Filkins, recently reported, he wrote a story in the New York Times about one area where the entire police force went over to the Taliban, and before they left town, they burned down the police station. You know, you read stories like that, and you really wonder whether it's possible to even meet the number goal of security forces. I think the number that I read is 350,000. They're hoping to have that many people under arms, trained and ready to go over the next couple of years. You have to wonder, well, can that actually be realized?
Well, probably not. You know, it's not going to be realized the way we hope it to be, you know, then. But you know, again, to explain why these things happen, why the police, you know, runs over to the Taliban. Again, you can't, you know, the messages that are given to Afghans at the moment are very contradictory. On the one, we are building up your army, we are helping you with that, but we are also leaving. And again, you know, we have to, in order to understand Afghanistan, we have to try to see these events, these announcements, through the Afghan eyes, through, you know, the way they will interpret the announcements. So again, you know, the message that NATO and the United States are going to leave Afghanistan is a message of reassurance to the Taliban. And of course, for the army, that, you know, people deployed in the police force, they know that if Americans are leaving, most probably the Taliban will take over. So they don't want to risk being associated with an army that is going to leave. And in order, you know, it's just, you know, we had 30 years of conflict, which means that people are very careful about their loyalties. And they will, you know, wait and side with the future, the powers that are likely to be victorious in the future. And this is a matter of, like, basically securing the future of one's family. So the contradictory message is kind of, you know, hasn't helped the situation, of course. But again, you know, I do admit that it's a very, very complex scenario.
Let's go to another caller in Montgomery. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Just what you said is the reason why nothing will ever change over there. I think the people in general in this day and age over there have to fend for themselves. I mean, we could be there for so long, and then if we start pulling out and things start happening, like in Iraq right now, because it's starting to fall again. How many times is it going to be before we realize that as Americans, we're shedding blood and lives for what? And that's what my question would be. For what? Is it for our security? Is it for the Afghan people? Is it for the world? Because we're in a quagmire now in our country we've never seen in the history of this country. And yet nobody seems to realize that. Well, you know, I understand the Afghans' plight, but the Americans have a plight too. We're the ones wasting, you know, we're sending them dollars, we're sending them arms, we're sending them people, and yet we still lose the war. I thought Vietnam was going to be the one war we learned about. It's all about politics. It always is and always will be. Until we get out of that mode, we'll never win. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think that the caller represents the views of some number of Americans over time, that it does seem to be the case that a lot of people in this country aren't sure why it is that the United States is in Afghanistan.
Yes, I fully I can see their point of view. But again, let's go back, you know, to 10 years ago and the reason why this mission started. It had to do with September 11th. It had to do with the fact that Afghanistan has become a place where people could freely come together and plot attacks against the United States and, in fact, also carried out. So that was, you know, it was a dangerous place. And Afghanistan, even though it is far away from here, you know, might appear as very disconnected to America, at that moment, the destinies of the two countries came together. And we shouldn't forget that, because over time, conspiracy theories about September 11, they have become commonplace, and because of that, because people assume that there was no terrorist attack as such, or that the state itself was involved in the attacks, you know, it undermined the mission in Afghanistan here in the United States. So, but there was a reason, and the reason, you know, to a certain degree was valid. Now, as to who made more losses, obviously for Afghanistan, I mean, it's not a competition, but at the time, they tried to, at least according to some reports, the Taliban did try to avoid the country being bombed, being, you know, invaded. It wasn't that Afghans actually asked for this mission to take place. You know, the population itself, they were told to stay at home, and then the bombing took place, and the mission started in a way without the involvement of the population, so they didn't have much to say there. They were, you know, presented with a fait accompli. The mission was there, and they welcomed it initially. I think, you know, the difference, you know, in Afghanistan, the troops initially were very much welcomed. If you know, reports from people who went there in 2001, Americans who visited in 2001, 2002, even like up to 2004, you know, they report very friendly reception. People would refuse to even take money. You know, taxi drivers would drive people around and refuse to take money because they were so grateful. So the reasons we might have forgotten now, but there were clear reasons. You know, it was a country in the world where people could freely plot attacks against the United States and then carried out. So it made sense at the time. And I think, you know, we should bear in mind that we live in a globalized world, which means that everything is interconnected. And globalization, you know, the positive side is you can go to the supermarket and buy, you know, food from all around the world. You have, you know, access to consumer goods from everywhere. You can travel. But the downside is also that, that conflicts spill over and affect countries that appear to be disconnected. So because of that, Afghanistan is still important.
Well, you have talked about the fact that that a lot of people in Afghanistan, they think that it's important for the United States and for NATO to continue to be there because they have a certain peacekeeping function. At least the out-and-out civil war won't break out as long as we're there.
Yes.
At the same time, though, I'm certainly that people are angry because people die and people have been killed unintentionally. Civilians, non-combatants, people that aren't involved in Taliban. Certainly, this is a problem for President Karzai. How do people feel about this? What in the military speak they talk about is collateral damage?
Oh, it's been a problem for a long time, obviously, and again, the problem is that a lack of infrastructure in Afghanistan. And the fact that we have a guerrilla warfare, which means that whoever, you know, the combat takes place through the air, and that creates civilian casualties. So it's not a face-to-face combat, but you know, civilians are caught in their homes and then bombed, and which you know, I mean, how to solve this problem? You know, one way if we try to have a proper, you know, face-to-face combat, there will be more casualties on the American side, obviously. Hmm. So it protects American lives and endangers Afghan lives, the nature of it. But the Soviets did the same, you know, because we don't have proper roads, for example. You know, so the combat has to take place by air and create civilian casualties. Absolutely, you know, this is a great dilemma. Again, you know, when you look, you know, at the Afghan population, they're, unfortunately, you know, the only people who make an issue out of this are the people in the south and the east, the regions that are affected by the conflict, and that's the Pashtun inhabitants of Afghanistan. They mostly live in those regions, and these are regions that have been, you know, affected by the war, and there is resentment there and much more casualties. The rest of the country, I think, you know, the north and the west, they didn't make an issue of it, I think, because they were spared the bombing. So from their perspective, you know, I don't think there was much concern, to be honest, which is really unfortunate. But what is interesting here, again, is that the Taliban also have created a great number of civilian casualties through their roadside bombs and suicide attacks. But we don't have the same degree of outrage, and which sort of makes one wonder, why is it that when people die in NATO operations, there's always great outrage, but when the Taliban attack people and kill their own people, there is not the same degree of outrage. I mean, another example is an incident that happened in the north of Afghanistan today. There was an explosion in a cemetery. And sort of, you know, we know that now we have Eid, which is a 3 days of holy days that are, you know, sacred days of celebration of mm-hmm. after the pilgrimage. So it's sort of a great religious taboo that has been broken. And again, there is no sense of outrage there. So this makes me think that perhaps in part the complaints about civilian casualties are actually political.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Nushin Arbzadeh. She is an Afghan author, journalist, analyst. She is currently a visiting scholar at UCLA's Center for India and South Asia. She also has written for The Guardian. She writes regularly for The Guardian Online about contemporary Afghanistan. And she has worked as a journalist for the BBC. Questions, welcome. We do have about 5 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit more about the involvement of Iran in Afghanistan. I'll bring up Dexter Filkins again, a guy who has done a lot of writing about Afghanistan for the New York Times, and he wrote this story just a couple of weeks ago about the money coming from Iran to the Karzai government, and President Karzai had to acknowledge in a press conference that he had, in fact, received millions of dollars in cash from Iran. He also complained bitterly at that conference about private security contractors employed by the U.S. killing Afghans. And in fact, I think he said that, well, the U.S. just leaked this information about the cash from Iran to the Times to make him look bad. So again, another ratcheting up of tension between Mr. Karzai and the U.S. government. What do people there think about the influence that Iran has with the Karzai government?
So this was, it took people by surprise, and even people who have been continuously supporting Karzai, they could no longer sustain their support, and it made people very angry with President Karzai, and sort of I think perhaps his attempts now to criticize NATO about civilian casualties or with closing down security companies is a way of gaining support, popular support, which he has lost, especially with the story of Iranian money coming out. As to the Iranian influence, Afghans have been very suspicious because it seems that Iran is trying to influence the Shiite minorities in Afghanistan. And the fear is that in addition to ethnic divisions, there will be sectarian divisions as well, which is something that didn't have a history in Afghanistan so far. It has a history, in Pakistan, for example, between Shias and Sunnis, or in Iraq. But Afghanistan didn't have that. So that's the main concern, that in addition to all the conflicts that are there, that Afghanistan is going to have the Sunni-Shia division as well. It has been managed to be kept at bay so far, but we have occasionally incidents of sectarian violence, but very, very occasionally. The influence of Iran is going to remain limited, essentially because millions of Afghan refugees have lived in Iran and they have been treated very badly. So there is no empathy between, the Afghans, so not really keen on the Iranian influence because of that, because they've lived there, and there was a great deal of racism. So that really undermines Iranian impact on the population. It might be able to bribe Karzai, but I don't think it has appeal among the nation.
Well, that question, I suppose, would be, well, what exactly have the Iranians gotten for their money, if anything? I suppose one also has to acknowledge that while to most anybody that, millions of dollars sounds like a lot of money, but compared to what the United States has put into Afghanistan, it's not very much. Having said that, though, can one really say that the Iranians have gotten something from Mr. Karzai for their however many millions they've given him?
Yes, they did. I mean, there was this sudden change of tone. Suddenly, the administration became much more hostile and critical of NATO and Western allies. Ahmadinejad was actually allowed to come to Kabul to give a talk in front of Western officials. Some of Afghan officials were so disgusted that they left the meeting, but that itself was quite extraordinary. At the time, all this was interpreted as Karzai trying to forge new alliances in the region for fear of being abandoned. But certainly there was a sudden shift in tone, which could have been, the influence of Tehran, of course. And yes, you're absolutely right. The money that he got, Karzai received from Iran is nothing by comparison to, 10 years of, financial and military support he has received from NATO, which just shows that perhaps the president is really no longer fit to run the country. I mean, to run Kabul, to be more precise, because he has very little power.
Well, I suppose that, yes, that gets to another question about what sort of power does the Karzai government have much in the way of power outside of the city limits of Kabul?
Very little, and that's something that has been historically the case in Afghanistan, that the central government's hold over the provinces has been very limited, and we had sort of rebellions throughout our history. But that's a structural problem that he has inherited. You know, this is something that has been there for a long time.
Well, that certainly would suggest that we can talk all day about, or the United States can talk all day about what it is they want President Karzai to do. Aren't there real questions about just how limited his authority really is?
Yes, it's absolutely, you know, to focus on Karzai alone just doesn't make sense, because he's not a Saddam Hussein or, you know, someone like Ahmadinejad who really has power. His power is fairly limited. But, you know, before we finish, I just want to point out the young generation in Afghanistan, this is a, you know, that's, there is a, we can rely on them because they're talented, they're dedicated, they really are committed to Afghanistan. And they grew up in an atmosphere that was free of all the, you know, Cold War tensions and the murky world of politics of the 1980s and until mid-1990s. So if Americans want to help Afghanistan, they should focus on the young generation.
Just in the near term now, though, it really seems quite discouraging that much as if we had this conversation a year from now, whether things would be very different.
I do think that the change is not so much what has changed in Afghanistan, but basically the relationship between Washington and Kabul, which has changed with the coming to power of President Obama. Mm-hmm. All these problems have been there. You know, there's nothing new, but it's just that they have become much more public because the two administrations are, you know, they don't have the friendly relationship that Karzai had with President Bush. Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to stop there. Our guest, Nushin Arbzadeh, she writes regularly for The Guardian Online on contemporary Afghanistan, so you can look for her writing there. She is also currently a visiting scholar at UCLA's Center for India and South Asia. And Ms. Arbzadeh, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.